So last time we talked a bit about kind of alternative way of structuring permission checks, where we would, rather than sort of listing restrictions or filters on what operations a program could do or things a program could access, and typically in the form of the program has a user ID or something like that, or sometimes not, that we would, you know, instead kind of change how the program requests things like files or process IDs or network devices to limit what it could do by making it so it just like couldn't have the name for files we didn't want it to access. We saw kind of the simplest and probably oldest example of this idea when chroot, where we change what the root directory is for a process. And this kind of just naturally restricts what files it can access, provided that we don't have a stray file handle for something outside the root, or access to the devices directly. And we can also kind of apply this idea to other things. So we saw the example with Linux users namespaces saying, well, we'll just change what user IDs mean. So now you can't even specify user ID 0. So you can't run things as root anymore. And conveniently, this also kind of works well for the functionality we want from things like containers, where it kind of looks like a lightweight virtual machine, even though we're sharing the same kernel, same core, same OS is running, but the OS kind of gives two views based on what namespace we're looking things at. And we mentioned that this is kind of a way to implement sandboxing that kind of gives us different capabilities than we saw with our system call filtering. In the case of something like current versions of Chrome, they use a combination of these namespacing techniques along with system call filtering to implement their sandbox. And we started talking about some examples of sandbox escapes because kind of the natural question is like, how do these filters actually not work out in practice? And we kind of saw some ways in which they wouldn't work out, in which case, you know, we just couldn't set up the filter, right? It was too complicated to figure out what to allow and disallow. We'll talk about some ways where, you know, that wasn't the problem, but we, you know, the filter still somehow gets, you know, the sandboxing comment thing stuff still gets defeated. Some questions about things we covered last time before we move on to that. Okay, so before we move on, I mentioned last time we have a sandbox homework which you should look at. So basically, I've given you a little inter-process communication library, and your idea is just to implement the privilege separation pattern in a program we give you. And any questions on the fuzzing assignment that I can answer now? All good on that? Okay. Or at least not saying anything? Okay. So we were looking at a sandbox escape in RedC, and before we talk specifically about that, I will say, like, there's kind of two things we'll see in sort of the examples of sandbox escapes you usually see. And we're first going to look at an example of the second one. But the first one is kind of, is maybe more straightforward and maybe more common, is that the sandbox works fine, but we have some bug in the interface that is permitted through the sandbox that this allows. So, you know, interface, e.g., you know, example is the functions browser renderer can call in the browser kernel. Right, so in the Chrome design, they have separate renderer processes for each website. They can make calls to the kernel to retrieve things they need to do. If one of those calls just has like a buffer overflow or use after free bug, that's going to make the sandbox not useful because the attacker will get some control over something outside the sandbox. So that sort of bug, just in the legitimate interface of the sandbox, is one thing, one sort of category sandbox escapes. The other, and we'll look at this as an example, is that the sandbox operations like work as intended, but there's some corner case of them that we didn't consider when constructing the sandbox that allows the attacker to do things we didn't think were possible. So we'll look at an example of a 2019 bug in this container support software. So the idea is the container should be isolated from the rest of the system. And ideally, we would have done this by using separate user IDs and using the user namespace idea. But at the time, this was not supported well enough on current Linux systems, so they didn't do it, which meant that the container ran as root, and the code setting up the container ran as root. And you can see that this is sort of very dangerous if we make mistakes. And the idea, though, was that inside the container, all the programs were running in a namespace where they didn't have access to files or processes that were sensitive. So it should be fine. And there was this bug where the bug was in a command to, we already have the container running, I want to run a new program inside it. And the way this command was implemented is that we start a process, switch it into the container, so set its namespaces for processes and files and mounts and all that stuff to the stuff for this container. And then that program switches to run the command we want to run. And there was a problem in this process where in between when we switched to the container and when we ran the command the user specified, there was this time window where code in the container could hijack that process that was going to run the command. And this was because of something kind of fairly obscure that's supported for just accessing processes. So on Linux, we need a way, and pretty much any OS, to like figure out things about programs that are running. This can be for like implementing something like PS or implementing a debugger, things like that. And the Linux mechanism to expose this information is this special sort of file system called /proc. So this is it looks like files, but it basically is accessing OS information about processes. And if my process ID is, for example, 1234, then there's a directory /proc1234 I can access that tells me about that process and has files inside it that tell me about the process. And this was set up within the container because if the container is running of normal Linux utilities like PS, you know, list the processes that are running, we need that to work. This is how it's going to work. And because we have namespaces for processes in the container, the process listing here, you know, it is actually properly isolated in the sense that we only see things in the container there, right? We have this directory of all the process IDs, but they're all the in-container IDs. We don't see any of the out-of-container ones. We can't, you know, access, name those processes. And among the things here is an alias for the executable file a process is running. procpid.exe. You know, that's probably really useful if we're like writing a debugger or process listing utility to be able to identify the file. You know, for a debugger, we probably want to read the file. Yeah, so that's there. The process was that, you know, when we run this command, we'd switch the current process to that container, then execute a command from that current process. And during this time window, we have this process in the container, and as root, if we have access to a file, we can usually overwrite it. The code in the container is running as root, and it had the ability to name the process that was launching this program using procself.exe. That was an alias for it, or not proc. I should say procpid.exe. right? We could name that file now, which normally we couldn't do. Right, because normally it was prevented by our namespaces, but this proc gives us a handle to it. So that is the bug. And you can see that, like, all the interfaces here are kind of intended, right? We want to have the slash proc thing to support full access to processes for everything we access processes for. And we think that that's deliberately set up, and we think it's safe because it's limited to things in the container. But the problem is that we have this unintended way that could be used in this time window where we were sort of starting an application. So this was basically the bug. That was a little more complicated than this, because this, you know, seems like something that could very well surprise you, right? If you were implementing this container functionality, you might think, wait a moment, I just run a program in the container and it can access all the files of that program from other things in the container? Well, turns out yes. But the people who implemented the run command in container actually knew about this problem. And they thought they fixed it. So there's a way of making that proc pid.exe file not work. So they thought they'd resolve this issue by making it so you can't access the original program. Yeah, should be no problem. So the real attack is that there was a clever kind of workaround for this. And this setting here, this just says, you know, make it so you can't access the current process. But it gets reset when we execute a new program. So what the attacker can do is that if we're running, you know, if I'm saying run in container ls, the malicious attacker can change ls to be a link to slash proc pid.exe. In which case, we will now run this file outside the container again. And because we're executing it as a new command, it's going to reset that dumpable flag. And also, it runs when it runs as a new thing, it's going to load, typically it's going to be dynamically linked, and that means it's going to load the libc from within the container, because that's the current namespace, and so it's relatively easy actually to get control of the program. And this allows them to modify the original executable file. And once we've done that, if we run the original executable again, that's the problem. So you can see, like, this is all interfaces working as intended. But the issue is that there was a way of using them that was really hard to anticipate. And this is kind of one of the reasons why people are kind of less comfortable with a lot of kind of traditional sandboxing, because often we have to reason about a really complicated interface that we're implementing. Versus if we consider like a virtual machine, all we have to worry is about like accessing a disk or a mouse or a keyboard. You know, that's a lot easier to reason about, like, is there a way of using this we don't intend? Whereas this interface, we have to think carefully about, oh, the execute program can mess with things. And we also have to do these things like disable access to slash proc that, you know, you have to know a lot about how Linux works to even realize that that was an issue. So this is the bug. So what was the fix? The fix they used is that they made a new executable every time you ran something in the container. Just made a new file with these executable, so modifying it didn't matter. Okay, some questions on this sort of sandbox escape example. So I mentioned the other kind of sandbox escape is that we have kind of our deliberate interface that's supposed to be used in the sandbox is not implemented securely. So some examples in Chrome were that when we make requests to like retrieve things from web pages from the renderer, there's supposed to be a check that like, is this a web page you're supposed to retrieve things for? And that check was broken in a corner case in a way where we could abuse it to access things we aren't supposed to. And this was a corner case which wasn't noticed because the corner case was basically that, oh, the renderer process should have been killed if it was bad, and they didn't actually make sure the kill worked. Or just a classic use after free. That there's a, you can set it, make a set of calls and have a use after free bug that eventually results in code execution. Also, there have been examples of other sort of bugs that, you know, that are of the kind of the other type. So on Chrome and Windows Sandbox had this bug where they had a Windows sandboxing bug. So the Chrome Windows Sandbox uses a Windows feature where you can have a process have an access token which says what they're allowed to access, and you can make a more restricted one to sandbox a process. And Windows was missing a check that when you started a new process, you could request that have a particular access token. And that's supposed to only let you start programs with fewer privileges. But if you somehow got a handle to an access token with more privileges, it would actually let you start it because they forgot that check. And the reason why no one thought of this as, you know, why they sort of missed over this is that getting a handle to a more privileged access token is not super trivial because the normal calls don't let you do it, but a way which did let you do it and was this sandbox escape was you could duplicate another processes on the system. Okay. So, talked about kind of implementing sandboxes in user space, and there's a bunch of, I'm not sure if this is current, OSs that do sandboxing. So like Android and iOS do sandboxing. Android is Linux-based, so the sandboxing is using some things we talked about. At least at the time I wrote this slide, I need to double check if that's still true. They used SE Linux, which is, it's basically access controlless, but for more than just files and for more than just user IDs. OS X does sandboxing. And for things on the OS X App Store, they want you to have applications sandboxed by default. And OS X, I think, illustrates kind of the classical approach to what do we do about sandboxing file access? Like, that was the real challenge when we were thinking about how do I, like, isolate a media player? And the OS X kind of solution to this is that you don't get to display your own file open dialog boxes. The OS does that for you. And the OS knows that the user really chose a file, and it can remember that this application was given permission by the user to access this file. And this, you know, require some changes to the application. It's not just a transparent thing you can do to any program. And one other thing I'll mention with sandboxing is kind of an other extreme approach. So Cubes is a example. I don't think it's widely used, but it sort of shows kind of the most extremely paranoid approach for sandboxing. Because we mentioned with sandbox escapes, like the big concern is we have this really complicated interface between the sandbox and the rest of the world. And that's where we ran into problems, that the interface was complicated, so that we like didn't think about correctly about what operations were allowed, or the interface was complicated, so we implemented with use after free or permission checking bugs. Cubes says, okay, well, we know how VMs work. VMs provide really good isolation, and we're much more confident that VMs prevent you from escaping the VM. It's not unheard of, but especially if we don't implement a VM with sort of complicated acceleration, probably that interface is, you know, very small and easy to check if it's secure, relatively speaking. And so Cubes does this where they just run every application in a new VM and sort of send the mouse events and keyboard events to the VM and back and the images out. And have some way of kind of using some sort of a network protocol to access files that are legitimately given to the VM. And they turn this into a relatively usable desktop system, where in this screenshot, the colors of the window border represent which VM something is running in. Okay. Let's talk about this. We didn't, I cut for this semester talking about SE Linux, so we will skip that option. And I cut it because it seems, it's an interesting idea that seems basically unmaking. Not entirely, but have fallen out of it. So we have like a whole bunch of things we might want to handle. We want to handle like security. We want to have good security, good performance, good usability, and good handling applications that we can't change. What sandboxing technique do we want to try to use for each of these? So who has an idea for what do you think is best for performance? Yeah.
Not super sure, but I would say my instinct would be V, because I think that would require the less, the least, like, checking.
Okay.
And, like, obviously, the dedicated VM, yeah, sorry, how we keep it overhead.
Okay, so you're worried that this should be bad for performance. Dedicated VMs, at least, you think are bad for performance. So, yeah, so I would say, why do you think dedicated VMs are bad for performance? Let's start.
Well, because, like, that means that you need to, for each of those, you need to have a separate, like, virtual CPU with separate stacks and separate RAM. It's more difficult to switch between processes. I just feel like it adds a lot of extra steps.
Okay, so we're duplicating stuff is what you're worried about. And you said a separate virtual CPU. What I'm most worried about is a separate copy of a lot of the OS. Right, we're kind of duplicating parts of the OS in each VM because the VM kind of has to run an OS. So I would be most concerned about the overhead of C. I think it's probably debatable whether A or B has more overhead. I think I'd lean towards A having less, because there's going to be, but it's pretty close, I would guess. Other ideas? Let's go with usability. What do we think is best for usability? Yeah. You guess A? Okay. So your argument is for A that, you know, even though we're using chroot, right, it's more straightforward where the files actually are.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be more intuitive for how this is set up. Other opinions? Any arguments for B and C being more usable, or one of them being the less usable, least usable? Yeah?
Are we talking about usability for the person on the computer, or the person writing the programs, or the person writing the
code? That's a good question. So. Yeah, so we actually, so a question we have here is like usability for who? So we have the for the developer or the end user, right? So I think you were arguing for the end user usability, would you say? Okay. But yeah, that might be different. And both are probably relevant. So any arguments for B or C being more usable in at least some cases? Yeah.
Argument for C is that it requires the least thought to make like a program run on it.
Okay.
Sense.
So
like it has all the features and you don't have to worry about anything being filtered or changed.
Okay. So everything should looks like full OS by default. Right. So that might be more usable that way. Yeah. So I would say, like, as far as, like, can we get the program to work? C is best for that. Because we have a quote-unquote normal OS that's running in. The argument for B being most usable, I think, is that the mount namespaces and bind mounts let us be very flexible in what files we give access to in a way that the other options make a lot more awkward. And that's kind of a big, big benefit. So easier to give selective access to files using that mechanism. And how about handling unchanged applications? Who thinks something is better or worse for that? No opinions. Is there anywhere concerned about being bad for handling unchanged applications? Yeah. I just want to run, my mail client in a sandbox. I don't want to recompile it. Yeah. So that would say it would be easiest? Yeah. So a virtual machine kind of gives the most flexibility for the environment. I'd say that B also gives us similar flexibility. A, I'd be most concerned about, because we saw we couldn't easily figure things, certain things out from system call filters. And that also configuring system call filters was a lot of work with an existing application, which might have like tons of ways of making system calls. So I'd be most concerned about A being tricky to make work with system call filters, with an unchanged application. And also, because we're doing just one CH route, we probably have to move all the files around for the application, and that would be another change. Whereas we can make files appear to be in the same place in both of the other schemes. And as far as security goes, I think I already mentioned, like C seems like the safest bet for security, and probably what we really want to do is a combination of A and B, if we're not doing a full virtual machine, which again has this big performance overhead. And probably more than performance of like memory usage overhead. Okay, so one, so we talked about sandboxing where we have kind of operating system support. And this is probably what you want to do. You know, if you have the option, and provide, you know, and can have hardware assistance. But there's some problems with this in some cases, and one of the problems is that, you know, if we have hardware-assisted sandboxing support, then there's always going to be a cost to sending information between in and out of the sandbox. If they're in separate processes, we have to, you know, it's going to take some time to send that information back and forth. That would, and the other big concern is just portability, that this sandboxing code is really OS-specific and requires a really good knowledge of the OS APIs when you're getting into more complicated sandboxing. You know, so, like, for example, like I told you a bunch of the Linux mechanisms, and there's all these moving pieces, and I just kind of briefly alluded to, we have that Chrome does sandboxing on Windows, and there's this completely different interface they have to deal with there. And probably the story on OS X is similar. There's another completely different interface they have to deal with to implement the same functionality. But we can do the same kind of idea as sandboxing without an OS helping us. And the classic place where you've seen this is something like the Java Virtual Machine, right? The Java Virtual Machine enforces that, you know, code doesn't do certain things, and the same with the NetCLR. And the idea is that even though kind of the Java Virtual Machine compiles things to native code, it enforces restrictions on that code as it's doing so. And we can also kind of achieve the same sort of thing for C and C++ code, where rather than targeting native machine code, we can target code that runs in a virtual machine kind of like the JVM. And the most prominent example of this is WebAssembly. And if we maybe we don't have like the C or C++ code, there have been research proposals. I'm not sure people are really doing this these days, but where you do an assembly to assembly transformation to add sandboxing, to basically add checks that the program doesn't do things it's not supposed to do, but you don't rely on runtime checks. You rely on sort of transformation time checks. So talk briefly about how WebAssembly works, because basically WebAssembly is taking this approach that rather than sort of run existing code as is, we're going to have to provide this virtual machine that the compiler can target, just like my compiler can target ARM instead of x86, it can target WebAssembly instead of x86. And it is in fact supported by Clang, for example. So you can just compile C programs into WebAssembly with Clang. And the idea is that this is something which we can compile like the JVM compiles into Java code, bytecode into native code. We can compile the WebAssembly code into native code at runtime, but also verify that, like with Java bytecode, that it doesn't do dangerous operations. And this is called WebAssembly because, well, the big place where this is used is this is web browser support for running kind of native code safely. And WebAssembly's sort of big way it achieves safety is that we want to not have like memory errors, right? So their solution is that we have a linear memory, which is a big array, and your bytecode manipulates this big array. And when we're running your bytecode, we don't try to check the bounds of all your array accesses. We just make sure you're in the giant big array that's your entire memory. So you can have a buffer overflow in your C program that gets compiled to WebAssembly, but that buffer overflow can only affect your program, even though it's running in the same process as other stuff. And this also means that compared to, for example, modifying the C code to check all the array bounds, this is way faster. Because we just need to make sure you don't get out of the big array. We don't need to check all your little array accesses are in, those bounds. And the other thing is that we might be worried about going out of bounds and sort of our APIs for the instructions and so on. And WebAssembly has this idea that to make it efficient to run the code, we have this separate validation step from the actual step of sort of running and compiling the WebAssembly instructions back to real machine code. And this validation step makes sure we aren't doing things like going out of bounds on the stack and things like that. And they just carefully thought about what things are going to be checked by this validation step and what things do we actually need to check at runtime and just work through that. So things they validate is that WebAssembly uses RPN. So you remember the RPN calculator from CS01? Uses that side of design. So there's a stack that you push operands to. So the way you do 2 plus 2 is that you have it add push 2, do plus. And one of the validation steps is making sure that the operands are actually there. There's function calls that checks that the function, it checks that you have a table of functions and you only reference things in that table. And that's just verified when we load the program. So at runtime, when we're running things, we just look up at that table, there's no bounds checking. And also we verify that jumps go within a function, so we can compile a function at a time. We don't need to worry about or sort of handling weird cases. So this is kind of an example of another approach to sandboxing, and probably one of the more successful ones, because this is a very common way if you want your web page to do something really computationally intensive, this is a common way of packaging that functionality. And you can see it does it in a way where we don't really have to worry about the security in the sense of, that we can do have all that computation be available and have it interact in a controlled way with scripting on the web page without needing to worry about, I'm running this code that could be, interfere with my system. Questions on this WebAssembly? Okay. So, going back to what we said about sandboxing originally, talking about unintended functionality of sandbox operations. Probably one of the places where this has been the most prominent is in permissions for mobile applications. So mobile devices are probably the best example of sandboxing in the real world, but a lot of the way they get exposed is that we restrict the operations to these permissions that are usually exposed to users, and there's been changes in how they're exposed to users, probably for reasons you'll see here. And this kind of turns our security problem into a user interface problem. And we have some issues with designing a system like this, a challenge of sandboxing, because this isn't a simple case where we have a nice clean interface. One issue we have is that you know, what we want in a sandbox is we want the sandbox to be restricted to the minimum operations. And when we talk about like what Chrome is doing with its renderer processes and other web browsers, that's probably happening. But that's not, we don't really have the right incentives in our browser, sorry, not a browser, or mobile app permission case to do that, right? The mobile apps don't have a good reason to be very careful about what permissions they check. We can maybe give them more incentives. But historically, you know, people have seen that applications, without incentives will just often request extra permissions because that just works. And sometimes this is because things are confusing, right? Like, the developers didn't realize that, access network state and access Wi-Fi state are very different permissions. And it kind of makes sense, like, and it worked. Or didn't realize that if you want to open an app store, install application is not a permission you need. So that was one thing. And also, copy and paste. Just the way you make applications, you copy an old application, you don't think about what functions are there. And the other kind of related issue is like if we're requesting users sort of change how an application is sandboxed, which is typically how we have to make it work for sandboxing that's for whole applications and not just parts of applications. Users don't, right? And an example is people did a user study where they told users that your job is to find and install this coupon app. And they asked afterwards, if they were aware of what permissions the app required. And most of them weren't. Also, way more of them read reviews for the application than read the permission dialog. This is why mobile devices over the past decade have switched away from prompting for permissions on installation, by the way, because of this problem. And the other issue is that users didn't understand what the permission thing said. I think that's just been cleaned up since like 2012, but this is another big problem with this idea of I'm going to sandbox applications, so your applications only have the permissions you want. It's another kind of practical problem with implementing that. And to see why, here's an example thing they have to deal with. Read phone state and identity. Which of these things is allowed? From that. Like, anyone confident? Yeah. I don't think actually. Do I have that? Yes, I have the list. So load advertisements is not one of them. So let's see, who thinks read your phone number is one of them? Okay, who thinks see you have called is one of them? Okay, who thinks track you across applications is one of them? Okay, thinks track is not one of them? No confidence? Okay. The actual correct answer is these two. But this is an example, like, it's hard to figure out how to get this information across to users. And you can see that people were bad at sort of saying what it allows you to do too. Most of you know, we're not interviewing computer scientists. They don't think of, and also in 2012, you know, track of Cox applications, but not as many people thought call history, yeah. Why would it? So. So that's kind of problems with permissions. So one problem is that our permissions like don't get set correctly. And I mentioned the other kind of sandbox escape issue is just through unintended consequences of permissions. So an example of this that existed in Android, the subject of this paper, is that they figured out that there were two permissions that together gave you full control over the phone. And these were the two permissions. System alert window, make a window notification on top of the screen, and the accessibility service, which is for implementing things like screen readers. You could draw on top of the screen, have a user interact with your thing that's drawn on top of the screen, and read the thing under that, and when they interact in the right place, they're clicking on the thing under your thing you're drawing in exactly the places you want them to, if you direct them properly. You know, clicking like the allow button or the install application button. So that was, yeah, and then we're specifically actually drawing over a permission style and just like putting a continue button exactly where the allow button on the permissions dialog would be. And this is an example where we're just not thinking about what our, you know, where we don't realize these, what our permissions actually allow. Kind of a big practical issue with this sandboxing approach. So that we both have problems communicating with users what permissions allow, and also it's often can be tricky to reason about, what operations in our sort of very complicated suite of operations actually let programs do. And I guess another problem is, just not filtering things. So, this channel, for example, observed that, we had permissions at the time for privacy, but there were applications that were just working around them because there were not things, because the system call filtering that implemented the permission system, didn't think of all the possibilities. So you could, for example, get the MAC address on the phone from an IOCTL that they just forgot to filter. And that's kind of one of the problems with implementing sandboxing across our full system call API. Okay. So I think that's where I'm. Yeah. And also we have other things like, photos have geolocation tags. We can't get the location you have now, but we can look at your photos and see where they're located. These kind of workarounds, and these are things that they found that advertising libraries were actually using in the wild. Because apparently there's a lot of unethical programmers working for advertisers. And also, sharing between applications when they weren't supposed to. Okay, so my plan for a topic next time is to talk about bounds checking. So we talked about like use after free and things like that, but let's talk about bounds checking. In particular, let's answer the question, why can't we just do bounds checking all the time? Right? Why does our C compiler compile code without bounce checking, surely someone's figured out how to make C code do bounce checking. And the answer is yeah. We'll talk about that, what that looks like, and why it's too slow. But like sometimes it does, right? So for example, if you compile this with modern Clang or GCC, you will get code that checks bounds. So why can't we extend this idea to like fix all our out of bounds errors? That will be our topic.